You're listening to Synesthesia, which is produced live in the studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nungajiwanang, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music. Was the work of Seth A. Smith from the original motion picture soundtrack of Low Life. That was a track called Rocks. If you're in Peterborough, Trent Film Society will screen the landmark film The Watermelon Woman, 1996, directed by Cheryl Dunier, on Tuesday, February 27th at Sadler House, 751 George Street North, starting at 7 p.m. with a pre-show. Critic and programmer Michael Koreski and food and film writer Mayuk Sen discuss Cheryl Dunier's landmark film in a DVD extra feature and provide some insight. The film is about an amateur filmmaker named Cheryl, played by Dunier, who becomes obsessed with uncovering the life of the mysterious Watermelon Woman, an African-American actress who plays the stereotypical mammy, quote-unquote, roles in old Hollywood films. A figure in cinematic history who's been cast aside. Little information exists about her, and film commentator Mayuk Sen says he can relate. He chases many people at the margins of culinary history for his work. He says The Watermelon Woman shows the need to build alternate histories that don't need to exist on this side of the dominant established white canon. Through interviews and trips to libraries and obscure archives, Cheryl slowly pieces together the story of Faye Richards, whose off-screen life includes a romance with her white director, Martha Page, styled after real-life American film director Dorothy Arzner. In a scene that takes place in the archives, Sen points out that the documents that were relevant to Dunier's research about black queer cinema were stuffed in boxes, and he says, "This white woman just dumps it out on the table in a really violent and inconsiderate way. Disrespecting history so casually," he says. There's another moment in that scene where she chides Cheryl for filming the documents in those boxes and says, "Respect your sisters, this is a safe space." And Sen thinks it's hilarious how the gatekeeper is getting to use the language of allies to really hold on to whatever power they have. artist, filmmaker, and scholar Thomas Allen Harris, who teaches the film in a course called Family Narratives and Cultural Shifts, is in conversation with the film's producer, Alexandra Juhasz, in another extra feature from 2023. Harris's course examines personal films by filmmakers and artists who mine their family albums to shed light on more significant social movements. He teaches The Watermelon Woman, and he tells his students that until very recently, if one were moved to delve into the archives to begin to look for Black queer ancestors, one had to actually go to a physical place, a space. You had to engage with a gatekeeper, if not several gatekeepers. It was before the digital space, where now everything in some ways is available. Also, to make sure his students get the context, Watermelon Woman was made at the moment being called a Black queer renaissance, years after the one in Harlem, and was born out of the AIDS activism, where queer folks found each other in the community. The Watermelon Woman began to look at the concept of the archive. The film is taught by academics, and yet it's a funny movie. Michael Koreski calls it actually a rom-com. Thomas Allen Harris says it captures the archive's politics, drama, and spirit. The Watermelon Woman elevates the institution to a new level of widespread visibility by making fun of it, says Anne Kvetchkovich in An Archive of Feelings. As part of her quest, Cheryl makes the trip from Philadelphia to New York to visit the Center for Lesbian Information and Technology, CLIT. Novelist Sarah Schulman makes a cameo appearance as the archivist who informs Cheryl as her friend that the boxes of relevant materials are not filed or indexed because the place is a, quote, volunteer-run collective. They tell Cheryl that the materials can only be reproduced with the consensus-based approval of the collective, which only meets every other month. Those in the know, says Kvetchkovich, would recognize CLIT as a parody of the Lesbian Her Story Archives, LHA. While some might not find the joke funny, the humor can also be considered a form of respect and affection, demonstrating the vital place of the archive in the popular lesbian imagination. The actual LHA inspires the same devotion that draws Cheryl to Richards. Conceived of a more of a community center than a research institution, one of LHA's original missions was to provide a safe space for lesbian-owned documents that might otherwise be left to neglect or destroyed by indifferent or homophobic families. Visitors can browse through the filing cabinets and shelves at their leisure rather than having to negotiate closed stacks. Organized as a domestic space, in which lesbians will feel welcome to see and touch a lesbian legacy. LHA aims to provide an emotional rather than a narrowly intellectual experience. Both the LHA and its representation in The Watermelon Woman point to the vital role of archives within lesbian cultures and their innovative and unusual forms of appearance. They dominate the profoundly effective power of a helpful archive, especially an archive of sexuality and gay and lesbian life, which must preserve and produce knowledge and feeling. Thomas Alan Harris says, the film helps students think about the ways that they can incorporate their own family and extended family and communities in making their works. And in so doing, they're making their own archives. Watermelon Woman producer Alexandra Juhasz says, part of the film's spirit is to show that these Black lives were lived. In the movie, Cheryl gives birth to herself. And a clear message comes out from the film. Make our history before we're all dead and gone. This is achieved now through the veneration of the Watermelon Woman, the film itself. Its remastering, reissue, and screening for new generations so that it can be accessed and they can be inspired by it, and it continues. If you're in Peterborough, Trent Film Society will screen the landmark film, The Watermelon Woman, 1996, directed by Cheryl Dunier, on Tuesday, February 27th at Sadler House, 751 George Street North, starting at 7 p.m. with a pre-show. It has accrued cultural capital over 20 years, and it's now considered part of a new canon. The National Endowment for the Arts awarded Dunier $31,500 for the making of the film, but then threatened to defund her after the release of the film, calling her a pornographer. Watermelon Woman takes a page from David Holtzman's diary and incorporates direct address-to-camera video diary segments in which Denier reports on her project. With her project, she manages to score an interview with scholar Camille Paglia. Writer Anushka Ratnaraja says, another dubious white female ally is played by cultural theorist Camille Paglia, who has become increasingly problematic in queer academic and activist circles, given her views on trans people and her strange, biologically essentialist views on sex and gender. In this film, she parodies the narcissistic white feminist film theorist, nonsensically trying to appropriate black culture to justify her racist views on white supremacist black iconography. Watermelon has the colors of the Italian flag, you know, she says, red, green, and white. She posits that black theorists are overthinking when they argue that the mammy role is a problematic one, claiming instead that she is a goddess figure, one of fertility, one whose domesticity is empowering, thus completely ignoring the fact that these black women and those they historically represented never had a choice about what kinds of roles they occupied in or out of the house, because they were enslaved. The film critic Martha Page and Diana all exhibit the benign racism of white liberal women whose acts of compassion and assurances of allyship are more about moral vanity than genuine respect. Anne Kretschewitsch says, queer performance gives expression to the cultural memory that is otherwise lost to amnesia.
salt peanuts. Salt peanuts, salt peanuts. Salt peanuts, salt peanuts. Salt peanuts, salt peanuts.
My name is Cheryl,
and I'm a filmmaker.
My name is Cheryl Dunier, and I'm a director, producer, writer, filmmaker, artist, mother, warrior. I got interested in making films, I would say, when I was a child. I'm African on my father's side of the family and African American on my mother's side of the family. So there was always this real interesting texture in the family photo album. So I always would look at it, seeing, you know, how varied those pictures were, lining things up, moving things around, creating my own sort of visual familial timeline with my photographs of my family. And my father actually worked for Polaroid. There was a little button on it that came all the way out with those first Instamatic cameras where you could allow with a long string somebody to make a selfie. So my father would let me be the one to push the family selfie picture. So documenting was the way that it began. Philadelphia is a great place for any artist or filmmaker to grow up because it's a city that's rich in history. But Philly is also this place where black people, Africans, freed slaves, went. You crossed that Mason-Dixie line and you were free. So it was a destination for black Americans. It was a place where black people were considered citizens.
So how is your video going?
Philly has really been good about having cultural markers of yesteryear, of slavery, of the, you know, this house was an Underground Railroad house. This was, so it was this place that was just rich in everything that culture was not telling me on the news. You could have been standing at Paul Robeson's house, and there's a marker right there, and it's like, wow, I'm right in front of Paul Robeson's house. And that's not something that I learned in school.
Excuse me, sir. Can I ask you a question?
Shoot.
Can you tell me, do you know who the watermelon woman is?
I think she's from Philly. Is she from Philly?
The one thing I think that Philly allowed me to really believe is that there are so many blacknesses. You know, there is not just one kind of monolithic black life or identity. There's every kind of blackness. I mean, again, being somebody who's African and African-American on the margins of both cultures, I'm black, you know, I'm treated like all black Americans, but I'm not, you know, I wasn't even born here. So it's understanding how you fit in the shades of blackness that this world offers and having something to connect to. And I think instead of having this kind of free fall feeling around your blackness, my job, I think, as a filmmaker was to make, and it's always been my job, to make this work matter, to allow people to have a legacy, to allow black women who look like me, who have a similar story, know that they where they came from, believe in themselves.
It was my mother's 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 recipe. The women in my family made it a little spicy, but I tamed it down for tonight. Oh. It's still very good though.
I had to invent my place at the table because at that table of blacknesses that were being explored or documented in books or in history or even on television and film, there was no one, you know, like that. So I just did it.
That was a clip from Cheryl Dunier, an interview on the Criterion channel on YouTube. For a complete playlist and all the links that I play on the show, you can go to the show notes on the podcast. You're listening to Synesthesia, produced live in the studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nuggetjawanong, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music. I've been talking about The Watermelon Woman, a film from 1996 by Cheryl Dunier. I'm going to play another clip from YouTube from a video essayist that talks about the Dunier mentory.
One place to start in terms of an approach to this really fascinating work, The Watermelon Woman, is to focus in on the plot or story structure of this film. And I think that brings us to a focus on the characters, perhaps led by the character of Cheryl, who is portrayed by Cheryl Dunier, and who shares the same name as Cheryl Dunier. So that, I think, already gives us a possibility or clue as to how much of this work we can absorb and interpret as a quote-unquote reflection of the true-to-life personality and concerns and viewpoints of Cheryl Dunier, the individual and artist and filmmaker, and how much of what we are seeing enters into the realm of narrative fiction. So fiction versus reality, or perhaps versus isn't the right word, fiction and reality in a type of hybrid or in a type of complementary dance or relationship that forms the basis of, again, this intensified self-reflexivity that is very much, I think, supported by the various references to cinema and also the references to filmmaking and video making and movie making that are part of this narrative, and also the reliance on styles and structures that could be said to be part of the documentary feel. All this is given a great phrase, Dunier mentory, by Cheryl Dunier and others. This idea of, again, the reliance on these narrative forms plus the reliance on documentary forms to create a true, say, individualized vision of self-reflexivity and individualized expression, a la Cheryl Dunier. We see it in a number of the short films that are included as part of the great supplements of this release, and I think The Watermelon Woman, the film itself, is a great example of this. And I mention those terms, or I begin a discussion of that in the context of the plot, because the plot can be said to be about many things. It could be said to be about this filmmaker or video maker or documentary artist who is Cheryl, and we see her and her friends and colleagues engaged in many different video making projects. One of which, of course, is a project about Hollywood history, and specifically about finding and tracing the history of one specific Hollywood performer and actor that Cheryl and others have recognized over the course of their own personal cinema journey, watching movies. They are really avid cinephiles, watching films and loving to watch many examples of cinema. For example, the examples from the golden age of Hollywood cinema. And in that journey, in that spirited journey, they discover an African-American actress who seems to have appeared in a number of roles, but who hasn't necessarily had, say, the great biography written about this actress. And so
you can listen to the entire 45-minute video essay by Daisuke Beppo on YouTube. I'll provide the link in the show notes if you're listening to the podcast. I am also going to tell you a little bit something that happened to me the other day. I saw two very different films, one after the other, and it was a strangely satisfying combination that got me thinking about this accidental pairings of films that used to happen when renting videos for 2-for-1 nights, as what happened in Watermelon Woman in this scene. Check it out.
You know, it's 2-for-1 Monday through Thursday.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm having a hard time deciding. What do you think? Cleopatra Jones, Jason's Lyric, or A Personal Best?
Well, Cleopatra Jones is really fun. Why don't you do Cleopatra Jones and Carrie? I think the two go really well together.
I know, but Carrie hates Sissy Spacek. She's all weird and pale and thin and anorexic in this movie. I kind of like my girls with meat on their bones, you know what I mean? Anyway, I just saw it.
Cleopatra Jones and Carrie. Now, these days, you don't have the video store anymore to have these accidental pairings. Maybe at the drive-in in the summer where you get two for the price of one. And yet, most of the time, the tone of the films at the drive-in is generally the same. As with most curated pairings, the focus is usually on complementing the other. Examples from the 2016 Film Forum program, specifically on double bills, include the partnering of Vittoria De Sica's The Bicycle Thief with Tim Burton's Pee-wee's Big Adventure, or Burton's biography of filmmaker Ed Wood with a movie made by the real Ed Wood, Plan 9 from Outer Space. Maybe one could program a documentary and then a fiction version of the same topic. I can think of something like When We Were Kings and Ali, something like that. I just found it fascinating since I just recently saw Husbands by John Cassavetes and Poor Things by Yorgos Lanthimos. And both films seem to hit the nail on the head on a specific topic by doing it completely two completely different ways. And this led me to realizing about Barbenheimer. You know, the recent releases of Oppenheimer and Barbie have made the instance an example of successful counter-programming. So now it's a thing. I wanted to look at the history of the double features, and I saw an article in the New York Times that talks about it. It's called In Praise of the Double Feature. There are times when 1+1=3, it begins. This is an article written by Jay Hoberman. At least at the movies. Return of the Double Feature, a 26-day retrospective series opening on Friday at the Film Forum, offers proof. They offered these double bills, MASH and McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Stray Dog and Drunken Angel, The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie and That Obscure Object of Desire, Singing in the Rain and the Bandwagon, Psycho and Repulsion, Sunrise and Nosferatu, and the list goes on. And it was not uncommon throughout the 60s and 70s for studios to release hit movies and sometimes flops as double bills. Jay Hoberman says that if his memory serves, Warner Brothers tried to attract both establishment and counterculture types by pairing the Green Berets with Bonnie and Clyde in the late 1960s. The double bill originated in New England in 1931 and quickly spread across the country. According to the film historian Paul Kerr, by 1948, when a Supreme Court antitrust ruling compelled the major studios to divest themselves of their theaters and change the exhibition equation, some two-thirds of American movie houses were advertising double bills. In the summer, especially, the promise of air conditioning might have been at least as persuasive an attraction. The double feature created the art of programming. Heavy drama is blended with sparkling comedy, Frank H. Ricketson Jr. wrote in the Management of Motion Picture Theaters in his 1938 guide. A virile action picture is mated with a sophisticated society play. An all-star production is matched with a light situation comedy of no star value. The double feature also brought about a new art form, the so-called B-movie. Most of these short, inexpensive genre pictures made to fill the bottom half of a double bill were eminently disposable. Some, like the horror films produced by Val Lewton during World War II, Edgar J. Ulmer's classic noir Detour, 1945, and Joseph H. Lewis's proto Bonnie and Clyde story, Gun Crazy, in 1950, were among the strongest Hollywood movies of their day. In the 1950s and 60s, American International Pictures made youth flicks like Dragstrip Girl, horror films like The She-Creature, and combinations of the two, I Was a Teenage Werewolf, that were conceived and released as double features, mainly to drive-ins. The double feature was also the rule at New York City's revival theaters. For cinephiles of a certain age, including Mr. Goldstein and myself, the double feature was a way of learning and thinking about movies. The double features in the film form series are variously linked by director, actor, genre, or character. Mr. Goldstein calls each a little crash course. Return of the Double Feature begins by pairing Vertigo and Rear Window. Both were directed by Alfred Hitchcock. Each stars James Stewart, cast against type as something of a perv. Most important, both are self-reflexive movies beloved by cinephiles for their fascination with voyeurism, fetishism, and other illicit thrills. To encounter these two for the first time at once could be a revelation. One of the formative movie experiences of my own adolescence, says Jay Hoberman, was seeing Jean-Luc Godard's Breathless and François Truffaut's Shoot the Piano Player on a weekday afternoon at the old Bleecker Street Cinema. The double bill was an immersion in black and white, Galois' enriched universe of Nouvelle Vague Paris, and exiting the theater onto Bleecker Street became a disorienting extension of the movies, a demonstration of the medium's power. Years later, as a weekly film reviewer for The Village Voice, I sought ways to review current movies that might amplify each other. It was stimulating to pair David Cronenberg's adaptation of William S. Burroughs' science fiction phantasmagoria Naked Lunch with Craig Baldwin's underground exercise in apocalyptic paranoia Tribulation 99, Alien Anomalies Under America, or to put the Farrelly brothers' gross-out comedy of Sexual Panic, There's Something About Mary, in the context of Mark Rappaport's essay history on Hollywood's gay subconscious, The Silver Screen, Color Me Lavender. I think it's interesting mentioning that pairing movies, you get to learn more about them. And I think that's something that could be done in class. Schedule a 4-hour class and watch 2 movies. And then another couple hours for discussion, of course. You're listening to Synesthesia, produced live in studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nagajiwanang, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. And it's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music. Perhaps Watermelon Woman would be great to program with Symbiopsychotaxiplasm, which Trent Film Society also screened just last month. Particularly to program Watermelon Woman because it's about Black history itself. But Symbiopsychotaxiplasm, take one from 1968, is also really great. William Greaves tells the story in Discovering William Greaves on the Criterion Channel that John Grierson's book on documentary influenced him greatly to become a filmmaker, especially since John Grierson said that documentary films could be social tools, social forces that could help move society from one level of consciousness to another. And from that moment, he wanted to do more than just act. He wanted to direct. Why hang out in a movie set when you can make movies yourself, he said. The roles to Black actors at the time did not inspire him, and he literally just wanted to work for the NFB and earnestly attempted to apply for a position. But the NFB turned him down. He brazenly moved to Canada from New York and showed up in person at the film board in Ottawa. And they eventually gave him the lowest job in the studio, splicing film in a little room. He worked there for 10 years on almost 80 films and eventually became a full editor. While working at the NFB, he organized acting workshops where he met his wife, and together they formed a film company and made films for a living back in the U.S. After his stint in Canada, Greaves wanted to participate in the civil rights movement in the U.S. and saw himself as another leader like Malcolm X or Martin Luther King. And yet he wanted to join the fight through his talents as a filmmaker. Symbio Psycho Taxiplasm Take One, said Greaves, was a departure from the kind of movie that I make that people expected to see. A wealthy patron wanted to fund anything Greaves wanted to do, and he decided to film a fantasy project and an experiment. His previous work, ranging from a TV news series called Black Journal and Still a Brother Inside the Negro Middle Class in 68, which filmmaker St. Clair Bourne calls groundbreaking for capturing black angst in suburbia, was in no way as experimental as Symbio Psycho Taxiplasm. Read between the lines, Symbio Psycho Taxiplasm is a very political film. This fantasy project is based on political issues of the time, Stanislavski's acting theories and his readings of social theorist Arthur Bentley's essays. As Scott MacDonald explains in Discovering William Greaves, a Symbio Taxiplasm is any social unit of people, everything they're involved with, everything they touch is a Symbio Taxiplasm. And Bill Greaves throws Psycho into the mix because he wanted to see the Symbio Taxiplasm of a group of people making a film and everything they touch, including the location and everything and everyone they interact with in Central Park. Greaves confesses to an attempt to play around with philosophical ideas, mysticism, and theatrical filmmaking. He asked, what would it look like if you took a group of highly intelligent people and subjected them to this complete revolt of traditions of Hollywood filmmaking? He said, I couldn't answer this question unless I subjected myself and these people to it, and we'll see what it looks like. Greaves was also curious about observing the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, in that the camera machine changes the essence of reality. He presumably had lots of time in that little room at the NFB, meditating on the filmmaking process by himself. He was curious about drama and rising conflict, so he purposely wanted to create controversy with dialogue and situations in unique ways that remind me of how films like Godard's Breathless or The Blair Witch Project improvised dialogue based on prompts. Greaves thought the nature of authority was worthy subject for a film, and he was curious about examining the role of the director on a movie set. For Greaves, the experiment's success came on the final day of shooting when the crew gave him a package containing footage that they had shot without him, in which they talked about the film's direction. In the scene, a crew member said, I think the director had this in mind, don't you see? It seems to me that this is a movie where the director plays a different role than in other movies. There's a director who sets up a situation, brings a crew of people who can think, and doesn't tell them what's going to happen. Yet, in the end, the film makes sense. Amy Tobin writes that it has the polyrhythmic elegance of its Miles Davis score, thanks to Greaves' innovative editing using contrapuntal double and triple split-screen images. Beyond mere background music, Tobin observes the score is the abstract model for the film's improvisations on a theme and an expressive element in its own right. Thank you. Critic Scott McDonald notes the anomaly of symbiopsychotaxiplasm's existence as unquestionably avant-garde, but black. Amy Tobin calls it a pioneering work by a black filmmaker. She writes in Still No Answer, in the spring of 68, there were, at best, a handful of African-American directors working in television and no African-Americans directing feature films. And for an African-American director to make a feature as experimental as a film by Warhol or Godard would not have been imagined if Greaves hadn't gone out and done it. McDonald calls it a landmark film, pivotal in the late 60s filmmaking. Suddenly, movie making was considered worthy of the movie itself, he said, but it was the most social of these films. Yet it was very personal because it was about him too, so it belongs with David Holtzman's diary in the timeline of first-person films. Greaves' film was certainly of its moment, and the director was perhaps uniquely situated to appreciate the various currents that informed it. You're listening to Synesthesia, which is produced live in studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Ngadjiwinang, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music. For the complete playlist and links, check the show notes. We've been listening to the work of Montag. From the music from the film Habiter le Mouvement. Let's just keep listening to Montag. Thanks for listening. I'm L.A. Alfonso. I'll be back next week.